The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 351, a paper entitled Love, Sex, and Transgression, Approaching the Unapproachable in Mormon Biography by Gary James Bergera.
We'd like to welcome you to this session of the Sunstone Symposium, 2005 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium. The number of this session is 351. We're very fortunate to have as our presenter for this session Gary James Bergera, and his topic for this paper is Love, Sex, and Transgression, Approaching the Unapproachable in Mormon Biography. I am going to just review with you just a few things that we hope you know by now, but please turn off all of your cell phones and pagers, other noise-making devices. Please know that this session is only by admission, by ticket, or by having purchased registration. Let me just take a moment to introduce our speaker, who really needs no introduction for most of us, but I'm sure you're familiar with him. But for those who may be first-timers here at Sunstone, let me just say that Gary is presently managing director of Smith Pettit Foundation in Salt Lake City. He's the former managing director of Signature Books and the former managing editor of Dialogue. You may know some of his publications. He's the author of Conflict in the Quorum, Orson Pratt, Brigham Young, and Joseph Smith. He's the co-author of the book Brigham Young University, A House of Faith. He has edited the book Line Upon Line, Essays on Mormon Doctrine, the autobiography of B.H. Roberts, and as well as many other articles, books, and contributions to books. He is also the recipient of the Best Article Award from the Mormon History Association. We're very pleased to have Gary with us. He will speak for about 40 minutes or so, 45 minutes, and then whatever time we have left over, we'll open it up to questions from the audience. If you are interested in asking Gary a question, we'd certainly encourage you to do so. And if you would come up to the microphone, just come up the stairs here, or if you're unable to do that, if you will speak loudly enough that Gary may repeat the question in the microphone for the recording's sake, we'd appreciate it. So now I give you Gary Bergera.
For the past 3 or so years, I've been working on and off on a book-length study tentatively entitled Love, Sex, and Transgression, The Disciplining of Albert Carrington, Thomas Taylor, Richard R. Lyman, and Joseph F. Smith. What I've tried to do is to narrate very specific events from the life of each man in as much detail and with as little editorial intrusion as possible, allowing the many voices emerging from the primary documents I've assembled to speak more or less for themselves. In the following presentation, I'd like to read several passages from this work in progress to give you an idea of what I'm trying to do. I'll read the introduction and conclusion largely in their entirety, as well as representative portions from my treatments of each of these men's experiences, except for Thomas Taylor, experience of love, sex, and transgression. At the conclusion of my presentation, I hope those of you with questions, comments, criticisms, etc., will feel free to share them with the audience and me. Finally, I should caution that the following presentation occasionally includes discussion of a frank sexual nature. The introduction reads, "The disciplining of LDS leaders, Elder Albert Carrington, excommunicated in 1885, Bishop Thomas Taylor excommunicated in 1886, Elder Richard R. Lyman excommunicated in 1943, and Presiding Patriarch Joseph F. Smith released from office in 1946 and informally disfellowshipped, were important events in the lives of each man. Their biographies, as well as the history of the LDS Church, would be incomplete without an examination of them. To borrow a metaphor from Elder Dallin Oaks, currently a member of the Church's Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, in a quoted document, to admit parts of the quote without noting the omission is to perpetrate a lie. We approve dishonesty tacitly by our silence, continued Spencer Kimball, former church president. Honesty is more than not lying, elaborates James Faust, second counselor in the church's first presidency. It is truth-telling, truth-speaking, truth-living, and truth-loving. Full truth, adds LDS historian Ronald Walker, requires the investigation into personality, psychology, physiology, and health and sexuality. It may also mean examining human weakness, human relationships, and the influence of political, social, and economic contexts. Each of the four cases treated in this book center on actual or alleged transgressive sexual behavior, and within a society that defines such activity as immoral, the silencing of discussion may disclose as much about one's own views of transgressive behaviors in general as it does about the activities of these men in particular and the churches and others' responses to them. This is not to minimize the difficulties, even anguish, these incidents may have caused the men, their families and friends, or church at large. Indeed, given LDS prescriptions against certain sexual activities as second only to murder in seriousness, each of these episodes may have been painful beyond words for the men and women involved. Yet I believe that ignorance, including attempts to conceal, serves not to minimize the impact of such acts, but to render them even more potentially devastating. Without honesty, counsels current church president Gordon Hinckley, our lives and the fabric of society will disintegrate into ugliness and chaos. In fact, suggests LDS biographer Davis Bitten, a frank acknowledgement of the weaknesses of the subject will usually turn out to be ultimately more respectful toward the subject than a cover-up job. At the same time, focusing on the facts of transgression necessarily neglects other, perhaps more salutary, aspects of each man's life. As Elder Oaks warns, severed from their context, true facts can convey an erroneous impression. True religion is not looking primarily for weaknesses, faults, and errors, President Faust notes. It is the spirit of strengthening and overlooking faults, even as we would wish our own faults to be overlooked. The writer or the teacher who has an exaggerated loyalty to the theory that everything must be told, cautions Elder Boyd Packer, is laying a foundation for his own judgment. He should not complain if one day he himself receives as he has given. We must avoid inflating a single incident out of proportion to its significance, Bitten continues, and presenting as typical something that is unique or out of character with everything else. On the other hand, he adds, I must insist that if the writing of a given biography is itself legitimate, then events and issues, challenges and disappointments, struggles and lapses should not be ignored or swept aside simply because they might be considered embarrassing. My intent in chronicling in some specificity particular events in the lives of Elder Carrington, Bishop Taylor, Elder Lyman, and Patriarch Smith is not to judge these men, to misrepresent or sensationalize their lives, to demean their memories, debunk their contributions, embarrass their descendants, criticize or ridicule the LDS Church or its leaders, challenge or diminish the faith of church members, or even to present these men's transgressive activities and resulting experiences as cautionary tales of tragedy and triumph. Instead, I hope to contribute to a more complete and hence truthful reconstruction of their lives, of the choices they faced, the decisions they made, the actions they undertook, the consequences they lived with. We must be careful, stressed Elder Neil Maxwell, not to canonize our role models as we have some pioneers and past LDS church leaders. not to dry all the human sweat off them, not to put ceaseless smiles on their faces when they really struggled and experienced agony. Such approaches, concluded Leonard Arrington, former LDS Church historian, are not damaging to the prestige of our leaders. We may not be edified by every move they made, but we are warmed by their humanity. Among the highest honors we can pay to any man or woman is to tell the truth of their lives. And complete truth is always more ennobling and hence affirming than partial truth. Finally, a brief explanation. The LDS Church currently limits access to historical and biographical materials under its control deemed as confidential, and under some circumstances extends privacy considerations to beyond a person's death. Personally, I understand such policies regarding privacy, etc., to reflect the Church's belief in the benefits of repentance and limits of divine justice, and not to circumscribe or hinder the work of historians, biographers, and other researchers and writers. For historically, the LDS Church has addressed many such sensitive topics openly. Detailed accounts of church tribunals, excommunications, repentance, sin, and transgression may be found in the Church's scriptures and revelations, in founding prophet Joseph Smith's History of the Church, on the pages of periodicals such as the Deseret News and Latter-day Saints Millennial Star, and in the multi-volume Journal History of the Church, among other readily available sources. The next excerpt comes from the first chapter, entitled Elder Albert Carrington, quote, Overcome by the Devil, end quote. Sometime after her marriage in 1883, Sarah Kirkman, who had worked in the LDS Church Mission Home in Liverpool under Mission President Albert Carrington, told her new husband, Richard Bridge, of her prior relationship with Albert. In fact, not only had Albert and Sarah been sexually intimate previous to her marriage, their relationship had apparently continued afterwards. Richard confronted Albert in letters, but dissatisfied with the results, contacted Elder John W. Taylor, son of Church President John Taylor, who immediately consulted a small group of other apostles. In the evening, recorded Elder Heber J. Grant, one of the newest members of the Quorum of the Twelve, in late October 1885, met at the residence of Apostle John W. Taylor, President George Q. Cannon, Apostles Franklin Richards, Heber Grant, John Taylor, George Gibbs, Quorum Secretary, Richard Bridge and his wife. A letter from Brother Richard Bridge was read, also a written statement made by Brother John W. Taylor from statements made to him by Brother Bridge. This statement accused Apostle Albert Carrington of having committed adultery with his wife before and since her marriage. Sister Bridge was housekeeper at the church offices in Liverpool at the time that Albert Carrington was presiding, and she claims that he then seduced her and that he was the first man that had ever had intercourse with her. Word of the allegations quickly spread among Quorum members, and on Friday, 6 November 1885, John Henry Smith and Quorum Secretary George Gibbs met with former British Mission employees Mary Nolan and Jeanette Patton. This time, the former gave some damaging testimony against Brother Carrington, wrote John Henry. The latter was unwilling to say anything. The two men formally submitted their findings to Quorum members later that same day. The following members of the Twelve were together this evening in the historian's office, John Henry Smith recorded. Wilfred Woodruff, Lorenzo Snow, Erastus Snow, Franklin Richards, Brigham Young Jr., Albert Carrington, Moses Taylor, Francis Lyman, Heber Grant, John W. Taylor, John W. Young, Counselor, and myself, and George Gibbs met together. Brother Richard Bridge and wife Sarah Kirkman made a charge of adultery in writing against Brother Albert Carrington. Brother John W. Taylor, to whom the complaint was made, stated the case, and I gave what evidence I had obtained. Brother Albert Carrington got up and confessed to guilt with Jeanette Johnson, Ruth Warsdale, and Sarah Bridge. All of the brethren but Brother George Gibbs spoke and could find no way to do but cut Brother Albert Carrington off from the church. Brother Wilfred Woodruff decided that he be cut off, and he was sustained by the vote of all present. 28-year-old Heber Grant, furious at Albert's deception, added, Albert Carrington's mind was so darkened that he appeared to have no real appreciation of the crime he had committed, and claimed that inasmuch as he did not go the whole figure, as he called it, that he had not committed adultery, and went so far as to thank God for his goodness in preventing him from ever having committed adultery. By not going the whole figure, he explained, that he would enter a woman, and before he had an emission, he would withdraw and not spill his seed within the woman, And as there was no mixing of seed, there was and could not be an adulteration, and therefore no adultery. He claimed that his actions were wrong, but he only looked upon what he had done as a little folly in Israel, but actually insisted that he saw no reason why we could not forgive him and retain him in fellowship in our quorum. Never in my life have I listened to a more disgusting recital than the confessions from the old man's lips this night. And I pray to God that I may never be called upon to listen to another, especially when a high official in the church shall be the guilty person. His crimes had extended over a period of 10 years, during all of which time he had been preaching purity of life, etc., to a fallen world, and testifying to the restoration of God's kingdom on the earth. Special meeting of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, Wilford Woodruff wrote to the First Presidency the next day. The object of the meeting was to consider a charge of fornication and adultery against Albert Carrington made by Richard and Sarah Bridge of Salt Lake City. Brother Carrington claimed that he did not spill his seed inside of these women, that he did not mix his seed with theirs, that the mixing of the seed was what he terms adultery, against which he said he had a natural abhorrence from his youth up, and he thanks the Lord for having kept him from doing that which alone was regarded by him as adultery. The council each spoke in turn and was unanimous in their feeling. President Woodruff, after expressing his feeling in full, decided that Albert Carrington be excommunicated from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for the crimes of lewd and lascivious conduct, fornication and adultery, which decision was sustained by unanimous vote of the 12. Brother Carrington pled for forgiveness and asked if he were cut off that he might be recommended to the mercy of the First Presidency for rebaptism, which the council felt that it could not consistently do. Since to his mind he had not technically committed adultery, Albert, now 72, was mystified at his colleague's reaction to his folly, writing in his diary, "At Council of the Twelve, where they excommunicated me from the church for lewd and lascivious conduct and adultery, the last of which I never committed even in thought, as I understood the English language." His brethren, however, evidently interpreted Albert's reasoning as both proof of an unrepentant attitude and as an insult to the office of to the holy office of apostle. There are hints that Albert's first wife, Rhoda, did not respond favorably to the prospect of additional wives, and as a consequence, Albert may have felt less constrained regarding extramarital sexual activity. Still, most of his brethren may have wondered why Albert, as family patriarch, had not simply brought Sarah to Utah and married her, regardless of Rhoda's reaction. The next excerpt comes from Chapter 3, entitled Elder Richard R. Lyman, quote, the consuming anguish that rankles in my heart, end quote. During his early years as apostle, Richard Lyman, like other LDS church leaders, confronted the challenges of abolishing completely the church's decades-long practice of plural marriage. Previously, the church had issued two separate declarations prohibiting plural marriage, the first in September 1890, announcing the ban, the second in April 1904, threatening excommunication to the disobedient. He also knew that church officials had not always been entirely forthcoming about their practice of polygamy. In 1921, he noted Anthony Ivan's admission that while in Mexico, he was instructed to tell the Mexican government he was not there to perform plural marriages, and at the same time, he was instructed to perform plural marriages. The next year, Richard was asked to help investigate the case of Danish convert Victor Hegsted, who had married a second plural wife, Anna Sophie Jacobson, sometime after 1904. Anna Jacobson, born on 11 July 1872 in Norway, had joined the LDS church there and migrated to the United States. The 56-year-old Hegsted told Richard the couple had married before 1904, but it soon became evident that Anna had not arrived in the United States until 1905 and had not begun living with Victor until 1907. To avoid excommunication, Victor confessed, agreed to leave Anna, and moved to Arizona. He died nearly 20 years later in 1941 in Salt Lake City. Anna, who was excommunicated in 1921, relocated to Salt Lake City, where she worked a variety of jobs, including seamstress and dressmaker. Since Richard had helped to investigate Victor's plural marriages, he was later asked to supervise Anna's return to church activity. "The woman involved came here from a foreign land, a convert to the church," Richard wrote in 1956. Thinking it was proper for her to do so, she married in polygamy and for so doing was excommunicated from the church. President Ivins thought she was unfairly treated, and he put on me the responsibility of getting her back into the church. I did this. Since she had had her church membership in Idaho, this took a long time, and it required my holding many intimate interviews with the woman. Richard found Anna to be wonderfully unselfish and helpful. But Anna was concerned that she was getting along in years with little or no hope of having a husband, even in the great beyond. Despite his marriage to Amy Brown, Richard and Anna soon fell in love, and on 9 November 1925, 3.5 years after they first met, both apparently agreed that when death took either of us, the other would undertake to have us sealed to each other in a temple ceremony. Richard was 54, Anna 53. As a result, Richard came to look upon Anna, quote, as my prospective plural wife, end quote. He continued to encourage her to remain active in the church, visiting her only during the day and never in the privacy of her apartment. In what may be the fullest extant account of their relationship, written only 10 months before his death, Richard explained, during the years in which I handled this case, Miss Jacobson explained repeatedly how greatly she was disappointed to be getting so far along in years with no husband. This woman had so many virtues and had done so much in an unselfish way for others that she and I agreed that while the present practice of the church would not permit her to become my plural wife, I began regarding her as my prospective plural wife, with the mutual understanding that when by death or any other cause it would be possible for her to be my plural wife, the ceremony would be performed. Following his return from Europe, where he served as mission president in 1938, and, quote, the long separation and the fiery nearness of her being my prospective plural wife, end quote, however, Richard eventually accompanied Anna to her Center Street apartment. This, he later confessed, led to a temptation I did not resist. Their clandestine affair continued over the next few years until November 1943. A major element of Richard's interest in Anna was erotic, their periodic encounters confined generally to her small apartment. But sexual attraction was not the only component of their relationship. Although in many ways Richard and Amy Brown's relationship had been mutually satisfying, their years of marriage and dissimilar temperaments had gradually resulted in some distance surfacing between them. And by the mid-1930s, if not earlier, their relationship had apparently turned platonic. Where Richard was far more outgoing than Amy and craved attention and affection, writes Amy Brown's biographer David Hall, Amy was reserved and not particularly demonstrative, except within a small circle of bosom friends. Hall suggests that the couple's sexual remoteness and lack of communication may have contributed to Richard's gradual involvement with Anna. It seems likely, Hall notes, that the attitudes brought by the couple to their marriage from their upbringing made it impossible for an open discussion to be held before Richard's excommunication forced the issue. Also impacting Richard and Amy's marriage was the 1933 apparent suicide of their only son, 35-year-old Wendell Brown. Born in late 1897, Wendell married 25-year-old Rachel Baliff in 1924. Rachel died unexpectedly 2 years later, in late 1926, and Wendell sank into a serious depression. By the early 1930s, according to Hall, Wendell's, quote, inability to fully overcome his emotional scars deeply troubled Amy and Richard. He sometimes kept very late hours, which they frowned upon, and he drank socially and had some other minor word of wisdom problems, which created strains in their relationship with him. Richard felt these matters of such import that shortly before departing on a lengthy tour of church business in April 1933, he gave Wendell an ultimatum to straighten up or face being cut out of the family business. On Saturday, May 13, 1933, Amy returned after an afternoon of work at the social services, and Richard, who had recently completed his extended trip, had just arrived home from a late luncheon at the Lion House. Richard was settling down to a quiet afternoon at home when he was startled by Amy running into the house in hysterics. She had just found Wendell dead in the garage. The newspaper accounts indicated that he had been working on his car with the engine running and was asphyxiated by carbon monoxide fumes when he closed the door to keep dry during a rain shower. Reportedly, he had a wrench in his hand, which led Richard to later speculate that he had been looking for a leak in the radiator when the accident occurred. End quote. The Lymans were overwhelmed with grief. Richard stopped keeping a diary for more than a year. Amy keenly felt the pain but held her emotions out of public view, the sadness of the loss, methods of Wendell's death, and possible anger over responsibility must all have served to further alienate, emotionally and physically, husband and wife. The next excerpt comes from chapter 4, entitled Patriarch Joseph F. Smith, quote, "Very human indeed," end quote. As a teacher, Joseph F. Smith was drawn to young people and their challenges. His letters written while he was presiding patriarch to an 18-year-old admirer portray an astute, affectionate comrade. Quote, there will be literally no end to the amount of good you can accomplish, he wrote in mid-1944, through a steadfast example and through lending a sympathetic hand to some boys who may be less firmly grounded than you are, end quote. I have a broad shoulder, and I want you to feel free to unburden any old time, he added less than 2 weeks later. It'll do you good. Quote, I think I must be one of the world's most inefficient persons, he confessed the following September. There are times when I feel that if I were on stilts, I still couldn't see over the gutter, he noted before the end of the month. Quote, then someone comes in to see me who has a real life tragedy to face, and I have to conclude that my own difficulties are of minor proportion. Quote, I hope I shall always be worthy of your love and respect, he counseled in one of his last known letters to the young man in mid-1945. But you must bear carefully in mind that I am very human indeed, with a very large share of human weaknesses, end quote. Evidently, Joseph F.'s large share of human weaknesses included, as he and others of his contemporaries probably would have interpreted it, same-gender attraction. And according to historian D. Michael Quinn, during the fall of 1926, Joseph F. may have begun a romantic friendship with a young man 6 years his junior. The relationship apparently ended when Joseph F. married Ruth Pingree in early 1929. Decades later, some generally partisan observers insisted that Joseph F.'s sexual preference was known prior to his calling as patriarch. But according to LDS Church President George Albert Smith, church officials did not learn of Joseph F.'s inclination until 1946. Quote, Brother Lorenzo Dow Browning called to report a visit with Joseph F. Smith, George Albert recorded in his diary on 26 February 1946. Lorenzo Dow Browning, an appraiser with the Utah State Tax Commission married to Ida Chandler, was the father of 20-year-old Byram Dow Browning. During the fall and winter of 1942, Byram Browning had been enrolled at the University of Utah, where Joseph F. taught speech and drama. Early the next year, on 11 March 1943, he enlisted in the U.S. Navy. Less than 4 months later, on 1 July, he was called to serve on board the USS Bennington. He subsequently received 4 medals, including one for good conduct, was honorably discharged on May 4, 1946, and returned home from Virginia shortly afterwards. The topic of his father's February 1946 meetings with Joseph F. and George Albert Smith while Byram was still in the Navy is not known. But later events indicate that at some point prior to his son's return, Lorenzo learned of a possible connection between his son and the 47-year-old patriarch that concerned him enough to personally contact his church's presiding officer. Following a visit in mid-April 1946 from Byram's uncle about Joseph F. Smith, patriarch, George Albert Smith decided to meet with Joseph F., to whom he was distantly related. Quote, Joseph F. Smith, patriarch, met presidency and left for home, he recorded on 1 May 1946. The encounter had not gone well, and later that same day, Joseph F.'s secretary was told that Joseph F. Smith was not to give any more blessings. Irene Bates and Gary Smith write in their history of the office of the presiding patriarch, quote, she was flabbergasted. His secretary never saw Joseph F. Smith again. 2 days later, Joseph F.'s wife informed George Albert that her husband was, quote, ill. By July 1946, George Albert had come to worry that the situation was more serious than first thought. Quote, met in office with Council of Presidency in 12, he wrote on 10 July. Quote, Joseph F. Smith, patriarch, case considered, bad situation, am heart sick. Quote, all morning I was in meeting with the First Presidency and apostles in the President's office, Elder George Fielding Smith, Joseph F.'s uncle, recorded of the same meeting. Quote, the regular routine was followed and then matters of a most serious nature were presented to the Presidency, which brought a shock to me and my brethren. This was of a nature that I do not feel at liberty or capable of discussion. It is enough for me to say that what was presented was a shock to me of the greatest magnitude, and I think likewise to my brethren, or some of them, end quote. In early September 1946, George Albert Smith again visited a still ailing Joseph F. in his home in Centerville. A pitiable case, George Albert wrote of the meeting. While he had met separately with Joseph F. and Lorenzo Browning, George Albert had never spoken directly with Byram or with Joseph F. and Byram together, and reluctantly convened such a meeting 10 days later. "Restless night," he recorded on 16 September. "At office 8:15, met with presidency and Joseph F. Smith, patriarch, and Ruth, Lorenzo Dow Browning and son present. Albert E. Bowen also listened in. Regret that the evidence is not satisfactory." Where questions may have lingered regarding the situation, Byram's testimony evidently put an end to speculation. Perhaps hoping for a last-minute resolution, George Albert met once more with Joseph F. in late September, less than a week before the opening session of the church's October General Conference. "Visited with Joseph F. Smith, patriarch, an hour at his home," he recorded. Fearing that the situation was beyond remedy, the church president wrote days later, quote, spent 5 hours with counsel in temple. Joseph F. patriarch is unable to carry on," end quote. That same afternoon, Joseph F. Smith submitted the following letter. "Dear President Smith, as you know, I have been ill for many months. While I am slowly gaining strength and hope again, and hope soon again to be able to do some work, I do not know when, if at all, I shall be able to stand the full drain upon my energy incident to the office of Patriarch to the Church. As you know, the duties of the Patriarch entail heavy exhaustion. Since but one man holds that office, if he is measurably incapacitated, its work must in that degree suffer. I know, of course, that one neither resigns nor asks to be released from such a calling out of personal considerations, any more than one requests appointment or asks for office. My chief desire is that the work of the Lord shall prosper. Bearing these things in mind, I am writing to say that if you desire me to carry on, I shall do my best. If, however, in the circumstances, you should feel that the interests of the church would be best served by releasing me at this time, I want you to feel at liberty to do that. I am therefore writing this letter to let you know that you have my full support for whatever you decide," end quote. 3 days later, on 6 October 1946, Joseph F. Smith formally stepped down as patriarch to the church. Quote, "Tabernacle and assembly hall filled," wrote George Albert. "Joseph F. Smith was released. A sad happening." David O. McKay, second counselor in the first presidency, announced to General Conference faithful, quote, "You will note that in the presentation of church authority, of general authorities, the name of the patriarch was omitted. After careful and prayerful consideration, with deep regret and sympathy for his condition, the First Presidency, with the expressed assent and approval of the Council of the Twelve, have decided under all the circumstances that Brother Joseph F. Smith shall be released from the duties as Patriarch to the Church," end quote. Thus, officially at least, Joseph F. did not resign, but was released, and not for ill health, but because of his condition. The final excerpt comes from the conclusion. Quote, "Let it be firmly established," suggested Douglas F. Tobler at the time a professor of history at BYU, "that all historians of whatever philosophical or theological persuasion are morally bound to thorough, careful, and fair research, to the discovery of all or as nearly all of facts, including errors, examples of bad judgment, misplaced zeal, sin, and willful wrongdoing of every kind. Any evidence of manipulation or suppressed evidence, submission to partisan pressure, or writing according to policy, should consign all involved to a kind of Dantean oblivion they deserve. This latter form is not history, but a Homeric type of mythology devoid of real human beings. These are like other products of an instant age, having been transformed and canonized with the flash of a pen into something few mortals can understand or identify with. Rather than serving as inspiring examples whose words and deeds bespeak the bread of life, their distorted portraits act as depressants, too exalted for we mortals to touch, much less to emulate." End quote. "Accuracy and reliability are the essence of scholarship," elaborates John Welch, editor-in-chief of BYU Studies. "All scholars worth their salt avoid material omissions, for often what is not said can be as misleading as what is said. Quote, truth, not deception, is the bulwark of faith," continues Richard Bennett, a professor of religion at BYU. Quote, "Historians must be as honest and as objective in writing history as humanly possible," advises Lawrence Coates, a professor of history at BYU-Idaho, "for to do otherwise would not only be dishonest, It would produce an inaccurate and distorted record of our heritage." End quote. Hopefully, the foregoing examination of the transgressions and disciplining of Albert Carrington, Thomas Taylor, Richard Lyman, and Joseph F. Smith helps to render more completely both the complicated truth of each man's life as well as of the history of the LDS Church generally. Tragically, each man's contribution to church and society has largely been overshadowed by the gravity of his transgression and the punishment he received, and one wonders how differently his memory and legacy would be had he not been a high-profile church leader at the time action was taken against him. Quote, "There are blemishes to be found if searched for in the lives of all men," explained Gordon Hinckley, "including our leaders, past and present, but these are only incidental to the magnitude of their service and to the greatness of their contributions." Quote, "We learn from history not to judge persons and events too quickly," summarized Leonard Arrington. Quote, "History demonstrates that people, all people, are fallible. There is no one without weakness, no one except the Savior who can claim perfection. This is not a negative or discouraging message, quite the contrary. For history also demonstrates that people can change and improve, and that even imperfect people can accomplish much good." Quote, "We don't know the whole person," added Monty McClaws, writing in the church's official Ensign magazine, "until we know the weaknesses and the strengths that are often only revealed through experiences some consider sensitive. Candid histories may prevent the pain that occurs when we encounter evidence of human frailties that our pasteurized histories have not prepared us to expect." End quote. The foregoing discussion may also reveal something of the deep humanity underlying the sometimes confusing, even contradictory actions of and responses to each of these four men, as well as of the beliefs and convictions of his colleagues in the church hierarchy. It may disclose as well something of our own possibly mixed reactions to these men's difficult experiences, to their choices, decisions, and dilemmas. At the same time, if one truly believes that judgment is God's alone, and that we ought to forgive one another, that those who do not forgive commit the greater sin and stand condemned before the Lord, then one's response, at least in part to these men and to others in similar situations, seems clear. Quote, "The Lord wants us to have charity and love and tolerance for our fellow men," remarked Hubie Brown of his experiences in the governing as a governing LDS official. Quote, "If we forgive others, including ourselves, the Lord will forgive us. There is no reason we should hold against our fellow men any of their transgressions. This is a lesson I have learned repeatedly throughout my life, and one I hope I will never forget. Thanks.
It looks like we have approximately 20 minutes for questions. If you would come to up the stairs and come to the microphone to deliver your questions, or if you cannot do that, if you would stand so that Gary could repeat the question into the microphone, we would appreciate it.
I wanted to just jump the gun for a minute and ask myself a question that I think some of you might have. How would I feel if somebody were to treat my own life with the same specificity that I've tried to approach each of these men's lives? And here's what I've decided. If I were dead and somebody conscientiously tried to bring what I hope I've tried to, the same kind of balance and almost non-judgmentalness to my own life and to all of the transgressions of my own life, they are more than welcome to try to do that.
Gary, my question addresses especially this last comment. I think that you did a tremendous job of showing sensitivity and compassion in your essay. There's a name that troubled me a little bit because I had seen only the initials in written form before. And I was wondering, I think you know who this person is. Do you know if this person died because recently he was still alive? Did you do the research to make sure that this person died? Or if not, do you think there are some ethical or even potential legal implications of including a full name in this kind of history.
Hugo, are you talking about Byron Dow Browning? I did not disclose I was not the first to disclose Byron Dow Browning's full name. Rocky Connell O'Donovan was the first one to do that in public that I'm aware of, although there are a couple of books, Irene Bates and Gary Smith's book on the history of patriarch, as well as Mike Quinn's work in same-sex dynamics. They both come very close to identifying Byron by name. What I didn't read to you is what I think might have happened between Byron Dow Browning and Joseph F. Smith. Personally, from what I've been able to see, I can't document overt sexual contact between them. And so I think that something else may have happened. I think, and I cannot show this, it's just my own impression from the sources, is that Joseph F. might have expressed some affection, either hugging or touching in a non-sexual way, but in a way, nonetheless, that some people may have found inappropriate. But that's just a speculation on my part. As far as I know, Byron Dow Browning is not dead, but I could be wrong in that. The last information that I have is that Byron Dow Browning is in an Alzheimer's convalescent home in Hawaii. But that was like 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago.
Gary, I have a memory as a teenager of listening to the radio broadcast of conference and Richard Lyman preaching strongly on sexual matters. Did you run across any of his sermons? That was identified in my mind, and my mind is slipping, but did you see that?
I didn't come across any public references to public discourses by Richard R. Lyman in regards to sexual morality, but I did come across a couple of references where, at least in a meeting of the Quorum of the Twelve, a year, maybe less, before his excommunication, he spoke about the sexual education of couples who were about to get married, and apparently he felt that couples should know more about their sexual relationships than maybe some of the other members of the Twelve felt was appropriate. And there was another reference I came across where he had been discussing sexual morality with, I might have been a young man who was about to get married, and the young men had a positive memory of that experience and I think appreciated Richard Lyman's counsel to him.
He was quite critical of his country cousins' large families. He thought they should know better.
Leo Lyman has just said that Richard Lyman was
critical. Of his cousin, my grandfather's large family.
He was critical of large families, whether it was his own extended family or other people's families. And he felt that way, Leo, because
he thought they should know more about birth control, I suppose.
So he felt that members would do well to restrain the number or limit the number of children that they have.
I was in the service in World War II and going through cadets at the time that he was excommunicated and very active in participating with the various LDS fellows. And I remember very distinctly being quite shocked because of the fact that this was a man who had done a lot of the speaking on chastity. And that whatever we had identified him as the person who was most adamant about his attitude toward chastity. And therefore, this was a very real issue because, you know, in the various indoctrinations that they gave us in cadets during the war, they were stressing the necessity for being careful to not get some kind of disease. And this was a very strong issue in the church at the time, and he was one of the most adamant advocates of chastity that I recall.
How did you feel when you learned as a
I was really shocked. And yet in some ways wasn't surprised, because so often you recognize that people who are particularly adamant about a given issue represent some form of denial, and that I felt that it reflected some kind of effort on his part, as it were, to compensate, as it were, for the struggle that he was having.
Gary, as you know, I sometimes teach life story writing, and then most times practice law. But in my capacity as a life story writing teacher, I get questions a lot about how truthful I can be about transgressions and the like in my family. And you've been dealing with public figures and published materials, but a lot of people that write about their own ancestors or their own parents or family members have the ability to write about things of a sexual nature that aren't publicly known. And I guess my question that I'd be interested in your opinion on is not so much the legal aspects, because I think I understand that, but just from your own personal feelings, what's your thought about whether those things should be disclosed or not?
For those of you who are interested in this topic, Morris has published an essay that was in one of the was published by the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute in one of the booklets that they do on life writing, biography, that kind of stuff. You're asking me how do I approach the issue of disclosure, especially it relates to sexual matters in the lives of my own family or in. So non-public would be some name I could throw out that nobody really would be aware of. Well, if I were, it's an easy thing for me to speak off the top of my head right now and to say what I think I would do, and it's another thing to actually have to confront it. So I could say something now that I might not do. But I think that if I were approaching something, let me bring it and make it more personal. Let's say that I was doing a history of my parents, and let's say that they have both passed away, and let's say that there was some incident in their lives that impacted their marriage in a significant way over a significant period of time. I think one of the questions that I'd want to ask myself is how much of an impact did this have? Was it a small thing that I found out about accidentally and that I could find no other evidence for? I don't think that I would deal with that. If it was something, however, that impacted their lives and they both talked about it in some form or another, then I would probably feel more at ease about talking about whatever this might be in whatever I might be writing. So a lot of it's situational, I think, and a lot of it is how much of an impact did it have and how many sources are available to you. I think those are also factors that would enter into any kind of decision. Does that come anywhere close to trying to? Okay.
Gary, I had two questions. First, I recall in Spencer W. Kimball's biography by his son, he has quotes from Kimball's diary about the Richard R. Lyman confession to the 12. And he mentions in there, if I'm not mistaken, it might have been another journal actually, but mentions something about Richard R. Lyman had also told them something about things that happened prior to his marriage. I was wondering if your research had illuminated what that was referring to. And also, I'm aware of another woman who was sealed to Richard R. whom he had known in his lifetime, who actually did have herself sealed to him immediately after his death. And I was wondering if you knew of other cases like that with him, and if this was, was this a kind of arrangement that he set up with possibly several women and not just with Anna Sophia Jacobson?
There are references to what you had mentioned, but I couldn't, when I looked at the references, I didn't feel comfortable in concluding that they related to experience, extramarital or premarital experiences with Anna or with other women. And so the documents in what I've done are there for people to read, and maybe somebody knows something else about possible relationships that Richard Lyman may have had. I've never heard of a woman having been sealed to him, so that's news to me. Richard was rebaptized before his death, but his temple blessings weren't restored until about 1971. So I don't know if women can be sealed to someone who has been excommunicated but who haven't yet had their temple blessings restored, or if you have to wait for that to happen and then that can happen after that.
Richard R. and Amy Brown had been close friends that had their families for more than a generation. And I believe he was fairly squeaky clean at that point. He had been at law school in Ann Arbor, Michigan. His apostle father and Amy went back to attend his graduation. That doesn't mean there weren't things that happened after that. Interestingly, I attended his funeral. Gary mentioned, quoted Hubie Brown, a close relative of Amy's, who spoke at Richard R.'s funeral. And yes, he had the Aaronic priesthood. If he'd had the Melchizedek priesthood, he'd be an apostle again. He didn't have that. And there's some question about how fully he had repented, and nobody's the judge of that. But Hubie Brown gave no hope or no encouragement for Richard R. Lyman. Now, just incidentally, Albert Carrington, on his deathbed, had the First Presidency dispatch brethren to ordain him to the Melchizedek priesthood. I don't know whether they got there in time to do that or not. It's an interesting question.
They just missed him, but they did allow him to be buried in his temple clothes for Albert Carrington. One of the things that's kind of interesting, one of the ironies in Richard R. Lyman's case is that when word first surfaced that he might be involved with someone, Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee were given the assignments of gathering evidence. It so happened that it was Joseph Fielding Smith, as president of the church, with First Counselor Harold B. Lee, who authorized the restoration of Richard R. Lyman's temple blessings.
When this happened, wasn't his wife the General Relief Society president? And she, could you just comment on, I guess she stayed for a year or something after. Just comment on that a little bit.
Amy Brown Lyman was the president of the Relief Society when her husband was excommunicated. She did stay around for like a year and a half, but it became very difficult for her. She had submitted a resignation, and it was accepted about 6 months later. But one of the things that happened shortly after the excommunication is that David O. McKay personally escorted her through the Relief Society offices as a show of support for her.
Did you say the year was 1943 that he was excommunicated? I was living in 27th Ward at the time, and he lived on 3rd Avenue between P and Q Street. And David O. McKay was living in this ward the same time. And I thought that I was a deacon at the time, but maybe I was a little bit older. But I can remember Brother Lyman passing the sacrament after he was excommunicated. And we, as children or as young people, really enjoyed hearing Richard R. Lyman speak, because he always kept the attention of the young people, and was one of the better speakers of the quorum. And we were so sorry to hear that he had done that. But I thought it was earlier than that, 1943. Okay, thank you.
This will be our final question.
Gary, the things have been in the paper recently about the dwindling membership of the church, the number of converts, due to the changes a few years ago where they turn around if a prospective missionary has sex and they don't call it to be a missionary. What do you think, personally, is it going to likely to increase the morality of young men and women, or are we training our young men to lie at that point in time so they can have the mission experience that they've been ingrained in since they were little children? And are we becoming, as far as sex is concerned, are we progressing or digressing?
I have no idea what the impact is going to be on the missionary numbers in regards to the Raising the Bar program that the church has initiated, although the numbers are down. But, you know, I don't know if that's what that means or why that is. And the church teachings on sex, are we progressing or not? I don't know. I didn't look at that, so I don't know. I imagine that if you ask people, you'll get a whole spectrum of response.
Thank you very much. This concludes our session for today.